All right, guys. With the threat of being out of peanut butter looming ahead...
Hey, they might not get that.
Well, then this is a perfect time to tell them to follow us on Twitter and Facebook so they can enjoy Murphy memes that you work so hard on.
For those of you who don't know, when we record, we are usually being held emotionally hostage by Mindy's dog,
it's
Murphy.
True.
In order to record and not be barked at.
Or bit.
We have to keep him occupied with peanut butter and Kongs.
So this is where you guys can help. Be one of our patrons at Patreon.
Beyond just peanut butter, your pledges help us with other show expenses, like our website and equipment. To become one of our Patreon patrons and help us out, visit patreon.com/rantsmacabre.
Along with feeling awesome about yourself for helping us, you will also be privy to exclusive content once a month, like exclusive episodes, watch-alongs, and other goodies that we're currently working on we haven't even thought of yet.
We just released the very first one, which is a compare and contrast of the original Night of the Living Dead and the 1990 remake by Tom Savini. And it's a fully produced episode for Patreon patrons. It's right up there waiting for you. And a reminder, our show won't change. It will not change. I repeat, every Macabre Monday, we will be there waiting for you with our regular shows.
But this way, now you get more of us, which I'm sure everyone was thinking, like, how can I listen to more Darren and Mindy? I love to hear their voices. But this is how you do it.
Now, on with the show. For some, the open water is a place of freedom, or peace and serenity. For others, it's an expanse of danger, a frightening canvas covering more than 3/4 of the world. Big enough to be all things to all people, the threats it might hold are seemingly infinite. From leisure to sheer ambition, the movies we talk about today take mankind to the seas, entering the void only to discover their own darkest truths.
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren, and we are the Rants Macabre, a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of the Rants Macabre, please visit fangoria.com. Now, in the past, we've talked about the ocean a little bit, and you having grown up landlocked.
Yes.
You have a sort of reasonable fear and respect of the ocean.
Yeah, I guess it's not, I'm not afraid. I just don't, I don't go out in it because, number one, I can't swim at all. I can doggy paddle.
That counts as swimming.
I don't think so. I think, like, Michael Phelps style, that's swimming.
No,
I anything
think the difference
is
between
sad.
Drowning and surviving is swimming. You're swimming. You can doggy paddle.
Then, all this time, I thought I
people
couldn't swim.
People can't swim. That's usually, like, a line in a movie before they drown. When inexplicably, like, they just, flailing.
Yeah, I'm,
and that's,
I'm just,
that's
like,
not swimming.
Into that. Also, I'm afraid of jellyfish. Like, I know you're afraid of sharks.
You have
an irrational fear of sharks, but
I think it's perfectly rational. Sharks eat people. Irrational would be
have you
like.
Have you ever seen a shark ever?
In person. Well, yeah.
In a zoo or an aquarium.
In the wild? No, I've never seen a shark.
Yeah, so there, you know.
My dad has. He scuba dives with
yeah,
well,
he's
whatever.
A big scuba diver, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, even watching the videos of him doing that makes me uneasy.
Really? I'm afraid of jellyfish. That's my biggest fear in the ocean. That's why I don't do that. Also, I'm afraid of stepping on crabs.
Because jellyfish can't sneak up on you. I have less of a fear.
Yeah, like, except for their tentacle arms, like, go really long, far away. So if you
you're
see
talking
him,
about, like, box jellyfish or man of prey.
But, like,
man
if you prey? See a jellyfish.
Man of war.
Yeah, what are you? You're making up shit. But that's, like, the killer
those
jellyfish.
Are all, like, crazy tropical. Those aren't anywhere near America.
I don't know. I don't know these things.
Whereas sharks, I mean, they could sneak up on you. And that's kind
of. No, because one time when we would go to Boston, I remember looking over and seeing tons of jellyfish in the river, even in Boston and Cape Cod. They're all over the place.
Those are small jellyfish. They give you a sting, you pee on it, you move on.
I don't think you're supposed to do that. I think I looked into that and
you're
not supposed
to. I think
you're
right. They used to suggest that the urine or the uric acid breaks down the protein that it turns out not to be all that.
It's just like insulting because you just got stung and now your friend peed on you.
It's just shy of, like, telling people, oh, a bird shat on you? That's good luck.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, no, you got stung by a jellyfish. Pee on that guy. So growing up where you did you go on boats on lakes? Is that a thing?
Yeah, going on boats on lakes is a thing. We, you know, I'm from Illinois, so Mississippi River is a big thing there. So, you know, my grandpa.
Boat gambling.
I didn't do that. My grandpa did have like a bass boat and catfish and stuff. And when I used to eat like things like catfish, I would eat them occasionally. Now I certainly wouldn't.
Yeah, but I love boats. I'm not afraid of boats or being on the ocean in that way. The idea of a cruise doesn't appeal to me. But like, yeah, I don't know. We did a summer on a houseboat back when I was in high school. Yeah. I mean, it was like a week, but still. Lake Champlain. And I've been on like catamarans. I like boats. I like the ocean.
I like speedboats.
Speedboats.
I like speedboats a lot. That's my style.
Oh, city mouse.
No, speedboats are awesome. And when my friends come to try and see the Statue of Liberty, when they come to visit, I don't do that. So I get us on a speedboat, and we take a speedboat out to the Statue of Liberty, take some pictures, speedboat our asses right back.
Were you a spy? Like,
speedboat's the best way to travel.
Speedboat tours? The whole point's to look at it. You're on a
speedboat. You get out to the Statue of Liberty, and then they stop the boat.
Okay.
And then you speed on back.
Okay. It's not like a slow tour around the Statue of Liberty or a fast tour on a speedboat, as it would be.
That would be hilarious, just a speed vibe. There it was. Goodbye.
You're like, I can't even take a camera still because it's just shaking.
No, so I love speedboats, but no. Like, I've never been on, like, a big, like, barge thing either. Like, I don't even know how
I've
that
would be.
I've
never been on a sailboat.
I have been on a sailboat.
Yeah, that looks like fun.
No, it's not.
Why
if
not?
If ever a friend asks you to go on their sailboat, they want to put you to work. No one, you don't just sit on a sailboat.
Yeah,
no,
I'm the friend that,
everyone has to work.
They make friends with me because, like, you look thick. You'll help me move. Like, that sounds about
you've
right.
You've helped me move. And you are very strong.
So, yeah, so today's episode is a lot to do with boats and sometimes the ocean, but sometimes
a boggy, murky bog.
Yeah, when we talk about the reeds, we'll get into that. But the atmosphere to the reeds is really fascinating.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, so first off, we're going to be talking about Ghost Ship from 2002.
The original Ghost Ship, well, not original because this is not a remake, but there was the Ghost Ship in 1943.
I missed that one.
Which starred an actor named Richard Dix, which made me giggle for like
Dix
quite a while. But this is not that one. No, no. This is 2002's Ghost Ship.
Yeah, I think everybody knows this one. I mean, even from the commercial, I think they were selling the metal cord going through the crowd scare that the movie essentially opens with.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only good part about the film.
Well, there's a couple. But okay, so it was directed by Steve Beck, who was an ILM visual effects art director before he went into directing. He had worked on Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, The Abyss, and The Hunt for Red October.
Good credits.
Yeah. I don't think anybody would knock this movie's visual effects. It's the human element that falls apart.
There's quite a bit of continuity problems. Mm-hmm. There's quite a bit of filming the same scene twice and like actually leaving the remnants of that scene before you cut to the next part of it. It's not good. But no, I mean, yeah, it has a cinematographer, I think, who's like,
is the set design, like the miniatures used. But okay, so yeah, so it was, Steve Beck. He did before this make 13 Ghosts with Matthew Lillard, which was not an adaptation, but like a remake of the original William Castle movie.
Which when you were asking me about that film, you were like, what did you think of that movie? And it's not good,
but it looked fun.
The ghosts are really nice. Like, they're really not pretty, but they're ghoulish and they're great effects for the ghosts. So again, that's that visual elements there. The rest of it's not.
Now I wonder, because Steve Beck seemingly fell off the edge of the earth after
Ghost
Ship.
Seems that way. Might have gotten on a ghost ship himself.
And so it seems perfectly reasonable that he would just go back to doing visual effects work because he's clearly got an eye for it.
But I don't see him anywhere.
No. And he's seemingly alive. The internet doesn't think otherwise.
This was like the last voyage of Steve Beck.
Everybody in this movie just about is a name.
Yes, it's true.
Juliana Margulies was coming off of ER. Mm-hmm. This is long before The Good Wife. Gabriel Byrne, everybody knows. The Usual Suspects. Carl Urban, who's now in the Star Trek movies. He was in Judge Dredd. Ron Eldard is a regular face.
You can't name anything, though. You're like, I've seen his face before. And I fought with my husband to say that my husband thought he was in Reservoir Dogs. He thought he was Tim Roth.
Oh,
and like
okay.
I fought with him for probably the first 30 minutes of this movie, being like, no, it's not, because neither one of us were wanting to look at the IMDb. So I was like, no, it's not. And I can't remember. He's like, well, who is that guy in Reservoir Dogs? And I was like, I don't know, but it's not Ron Eldard. It went on and on.
Yeah, it's just I can't think of particular performances that I've liked.
I saw him. There was a videotaped version of Death of a Salesman, and he's, I think,
the
happy.
The stage play.
Yeah, and okay. I think he was happy in that. It was the one that won all the Tonys when it was revised.
Oh.
And he was excellent in that. So, oh. I mean, I know him from that, but was he on Wings? I don't know. He has a face like a person who was on Wings. I don't know.
So, but...
Doesn't matter. Who cares?
Well, rounding out the cast is the obnoxious Isaiah Washington.
Yes, but we didn't know he was obnoxious at this time in history. In 2002, we didn't know, right?
His character was just shitty.
Yeah.
Yeah, but in this movie... All the characters are pretty lightly written, and his, like, thing is that he's got a fiancé waiting for him on dry land, and he can't wait to get back. And all his character elements seem to be tied to the idea that he's engaged to a woman, and he's going to, I don't know, be a moral, upstanding human being when he gets back to dry land.
Yeah, it's like those, like, televangelists that are, like, saying all these things, and then you catch them with, like, a prostitute later. That's Isaiah Washington in this.
I got a fiancé waiting on me, remember? I mean... Getting married in a month.
Nice titties.
Not that you can hold the candle to the future Mrs. Greer, though.
So it was produced by Joel Silver, and a lot of money was spent. It cost about $35 million to make, which even for what it looks like seems pretty cheap by today's standards, because it's a great-looking movie.
Bob Zemeckis and myself had this idea. Well, Bob really had the idea to remake House on Haunted Hill. And as we were preparing it, Bob thought, look, it would be really fun if we could maybe make more of these pictures. House on Haunted Hill was good and successful, and 13 Ghosts was more successful. We want to keep going. We're trying to, you know, have one of these movies come out every Halloween.
The intention was to make really good quality pictures, pictures that will scare people, and just keep it going, keep it moving, keep the pacing of it really, really well paced.
However, it did not make its money back in the theater.
Because it had heavy competition that weekend.
Oh, did it?
It came out with Jackass movie. And in 2002, let me tell you, Jackass movie blew Ghost Ship out of the water. I'm full of puns today. Oh my God.
Jackass 2. Yeah, that's one of those like micro budget things that makes tons of money in the okay. And you know what? I like the guys in Jackass. Like I like those characters. They're funny. The characters in this movie, not so much.
No. I would have liked to have seen Steve-O see what he would do on Ghost Ship. Yeah. Why not?
Okay, so a loose synopsis for the 17 people who have not seen this film. After discovering a passenger ship missing since 1962, floating adrift on the Bering Sea, salvagers claim the vessel as their own. Once they begin towing the ghost ship towards harbor, a series of bizarre occurrences happen, and the group becomes trapped inside the ship, which they soon learn is inhabited by a demonic creature. Now, that's wrong. IMDb got that wrong.
Yes,
it's
that's
a demonic
not
creature. No, this is not a monster movie.
No, this is definitely not a monster movie. I see what they're saying, but it's incorrect and wrong.
Yeah, it's not the first time IMDb is just like really vague about the villain, but in this case, like it's called Ghost Ship.
Yeah,
there's fucking ghosts on it.
Goddamn ghosts! Don't be stupid.
On the DVD that I bought used for $2, the menu options are. Play, scenes, languages, and features. Not even special features.
Because there is nothing special.
This movie doesn't even have the confidence to brag about the extra
content.
Did you
listen to the special feature? Or did you... What are the special features? Oh, I didn't. Because I didn't want to watch any more of it.
Well, like all my appreciation for special effects and the miniatures that were shot and all that stuff is very cool.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, and we'll have little bits and pieces of like what it took to make this movie. And then it'll kind of bum you out that, like, this whole movie is a missed opportunity for a greater story. Mm-hmm. Because they had resources, they just wasted them, it seems.
From the outset, Steve was very strongly of the view that a large miniature ship would be used. That was almost a stated requirement of the equation.
Steve comes from the world of special effects, and this is a movie that is very heavy in special effects. He's really great at that understanding of what it takes to make a film like this work.
You have to do a lot of homework with that stuff. You have to prepare a lot for it. Whatever you can control and have prepped, people aren't guessing for it, and the shots essentially come out better. But Dale's been watching our hind end quite a bit, actually, lately. Photon has a huge job ahead of themselves. There's quite a bit of work to do on this film.
The objective always is the same, is to create a credible illusion.
The one thing that we have to do is with this picture is to keep the scale large, keep the scale big. And we feel that they're going to give us some things that you've never really seen in a movie before.
So it starts off with this nice little tune. It's like an old-fashioned kind of setting. We have this really cursive, crazy writing, and even the title is done in this Love Boat style.
It feels like it's going to be a campy
movie,
right, based on the opening.
But it's not. It's serious in everything that it's doing. And we start in 1962, and there's this big party and this very elegant cruise liner. There's a little girl who's
Italian
redheaded.
Italian lady singing.
Italian lady
it's
singing.
It's piped throughout the boat.
There's a lot going on. But then everyone's also giving each other shady, shifty eyes. There's a lot of shifty eyes. There's a lot of eye acting. There should be a name for that. Acting with your eyes. And so you know something's not quite right. And you get the best kill that I think in a lot of movies you come up with. This kill is better than most.
Yeah. In terms of slice kills,
mm-hmm.
I'm thinking there was the really bad, the first Resident Evil had like the laser grid chopping people up, and that was a pretty bad digital effect,
right.
But this actually used a lot of practical effects to sort of simulate that wire cord that sweeps across an entire crowd of dancing people, although the little girl is like, you know, sparingly
sure.
missed by the cord, but the guy who she's dancing with, that's a great one.
So what this kill is for the, how many people do we think haven't
17.
Seen this? 17 or so people, is this wire cord gets tripped, it gets pulled, and slices across an entire dance floor of people, cutting every single person, sans little girl, in half
and
before they even know it.
Right, it happens at light speed, so people are kind of, they have a shocked expression on their face, and they're clearly like a what the fuck
right.
appearance. And yeah, when people start falling apart, it's one of the greatest openings, you know, just this crowd going down is
so
fantastic.
It's like you start off good and you think like, I'm in for this great movie.
Yeah.
Very similar to how Cube, the first one starts and you're like, what? But then Cube pays off.
Cube was another great slicing.
Yeah, that's an excellent one. I think the first time I ever saw someone get sliced like that probably was Johnny Mnemonic.
Oh, yeah.
It was probably the first time I ever saw that effect.
It might have been the first time it was done properly. That wasn't like a, you know, a plane of glass chopping someone off in half like in the Omen movies. But from there, we go to this tugboat crew. They're salvagers, so they're pulling shit off the bottom of the ocean.
Right, and it's now 2002.
Yeah, and it seems like they're working off like an offshore drilling rig. Like they've hoisted something off the bottom of the ocean. They've made it buoyant, and they're going to drag it into port. And we get a sort of across-the-board example of, like, everybody's job.
Right. And we can see that they're a ragtag crew that likes to take chances. But Gabriel Byrne is no nonsense.
He's so tough on the radio. And Juliana Margulies is just, like, a stubborn, you know, she's the second in command, but she's not listening to the boss. And she's just like, I got to fix this or else it's going to go down and we're going to have lost everything. He's like, you're going to die. And then just cut to them at a bar celebrating.
Yeah, I guess it worked out, I guess. So many cuts in this film are so bad because you just go, oh, I guess it worked out. Okay. Yeah, so now they're in this bar with the foamiest beers I've ever seen, which that's another part of the continuity that you would expect from someone who's a visual person to have noticed.
Oh, do all the levels change in the glasses?
All the time.
And I then didn't notice really, that.
I noticed it because it, one in particular.
You were really thirsty
like,
when you watched it.
It's so foamy. It's like the foamiest beer ever.
You're like, this bartender needs to be fired. Change the tap or at least tip the glass over a little
what
bit
is
when
going,
you're pouring.
Well, but it's in a bottle because they're rough and tumble.
Okay. Ah.
You know, they drink. It's not their birthday.
Do you want a glass with that? No. I'm part of a tugboat crew.
Exactly. There's no glasses here in the Bering Strait bar or wherever the shit we are. I don't really know.
Juliana Margulies is playing Epps.
Yeah.
I think it's the only way she... I think they reveal her name later. It's
yes,
supposed
they
to do. Be a thing. But in any case, like, she's very much the protagonist. It's an ensemble cast, but she's the main character.
Mm-hmm.
And on the extra features, they really commit to, like... a woman lead, our rough and tumble Epps is like really, you know, getting through all this you know, business.
Yeah.
And it just starting her off on like a stubborn, tough angle. Like she, you know, she refers to the crew as like her family.
Mm-hmm.
But like Ripley was a pragmatist who survived on account of making all the right decisions.
Right.
And Juliana Margulies is just stubborn and along for the ride. She seems to be the last one.
She happens to be the last one who gets killed. That's all. Yeah. I mean, well, that's not, she doesn't get killed. Or does she? but she's just the last one that the ghosts go after, really. It's not like,
yeah, she gets a little bit of protection.
It's not like she's better than
anyone
else. It's just,
no,
you know. But in this bar with these crazy bottles that change levels all the time and very foamy is a mysterious Canadian weather pilot reporter, Bella. Not quite sure. His name's Ferryman.
Yeah. Okay.
So, like, let's go there with
that. He flies
that.
A plane called the River Styx.
Exactly. And Gabriel Byrne's character should be, like, Captain. Sam Captain. That should be his last name. That's why the ferryman is his last name. But he tells them about this boat.
Well, I did 3 flybys and tried for radio contact and got nothing. So I figured she had to be adrift.
This was in the Bering Strait?
Yeah. That's 1,000 miles from the nearest shipping lanes. Why didn't you alert the Coast Guard? I did, but it's international waters, so they noted it, and that's it.
You get a name off this boat?
No, I put it out of my head until about 2 days ago, and I saw it again.
Yeah, and they now have to go out and get it.
He's got photographs. Like, he's got proof, and it sounds like he's sort of been shopping this idea around. He's seen the ship more than once, and he wants a finder's fee. Like, that's all right. He wants. But
and it seems like he wants adventure in the beginning.
Yeah, and he, right, because he wants to be with the crew when they right. find the ship. Nothing suspicious going on here.
No, he's just annoying.
So I guess they figure that it's a pretty big haul if they can work it out.
Mm-hmm.
I think they say it's going to take them about a week out of their way.
Some of the guys don't like it. They don't want to do it.
Isaiah Washington's very upset. He's clear. He's got a bride waiting for him.
That's right.
At home. And yeah.
Guy, I don't know his name because it doesn't pay to know that other guy's name. He definitely doesn't want to go.
And it's the very generic, like, one last big score and then we can retire, that kind of shit. And so they go for it. They take the tugboat out to sea, and a giant ship seems to sneak up on them.
Yeah, surprise.
Shit. When they get close enough to see it, Gabriel Byrne, he gives this monologue that's actually very good. It's just, it's very short, and it doesn't really have the depth of a story that, like, captures you. I think
right.
it's very much modeled after the USS Indianapolis speech from Jaws,
mm-hmm.
except it doesn't have that gravitas because he doesn't get very deep into the story, which,
yeah,
like, I'll listen to Gabriel Byrne read the phone book.
You ever hear of a ship called the Mary Celeste?
No.
She was a twin-masted brigantine out of Charleston, South Carolina during the Civil War. She was bound for London with her cargo of cotton in her hold. Thanks. Anyway, 2 months after she set sail, she was sighted by a group of fishermen off Tripoli. She was doing 12 knots an hour in a stiff breeze. Something wasn't quite right. They didn't know what, so they went on board. You know what they found? Nothing. No passengers, no crew, no captain. No sign of distress. 59 days after the last entry in the log, that ship had traveled 4,500 miles across the open ocean, past the Rock of Gibraltar, and into the Mediterranean Sea at full sail. And nobody at the helm. What do you make of that?
Of course, yeah.
In this film, and it's also, you have to know when you're watching it, because the acting performances are not good in this movie. And I think it's the viewer, though, has to know that when they signed on to do this movie, it was a completely different movie. And then it was completely rewritten. They were already signed on to it. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So it originally was just a pure ghost story. it didn't have all the effects. It didn't have all the murder, slicing, dicing. It was a ghost story that was like a psychological thriller. And that's what they signed on for. So when you see these like lackluster performances, I kind of think it's because they were just like, they were stuck at that point.
I was going to ask you why you think this movie stinks. There's a lot of things to that question, but like, again, we kind of touched on the idea that like they had all the set pieces to win.
Mm-hmm.
They just couldn't make it work. But it starts to make sense that tonally this movie is erratic.
Right.
And there isn't really a glue that holds any of these scenes together, any of these characters.
No. When Joel Silver shows up in it to produce this, then the script changes entirely.
Yeah. And he also had last cut. Steve Beck talked about handing the movie off to Joel Silver, and Joel Silver made the last cut. And I'm sure that's where like the really bad metal was applied.
Yes.
I mean, it's a rusty ship, but I mean metal music.
Yes, Mudvayne. Mudvayne in particular.
So Gabriel Burns is referring to the Mary Celeste, and this actually came up in our Patreon episode with Night of the Living Dead, because the house that Barbara comes to in Night of the Living Dead has the name Mary Celeste on it, and that was Tom Savini kind of nodding that, like, she enters this house that was seemingly abandoned at the last minute. There's, like, food still cooking.
Right.
There's just clearly been evacuated without a story. And that's the thing, that the Mary Celeste is a fascinating story. And frankly, I would have preferred to watch a movie about that.
Yeah.
He talks about the Mary Celeste being discovered near the Strait of Gibraltar in 1872. The crew was not on board and all the lifeboats were gone. There was seemingly no damage done to the ship. For the viewer who wants to look up like the idea of a ghost ship, all this stuff is available, and there was actually a pretty thorough investigation, and then people throw in their sort of theories as far as what might have happened.
Right.
But so first called the Amazon, on its first voyage, the very first captain caught pneumonia and died pretty quickly.
All right. Okay.
It caught fire once and was grounded and badly damaged. When it was fixed and renamed the Mary Celeste and shipped out, that's when even worse things started happening. Captain Benjamin Spooner Briggs and his wife and daughter, plus 8 crewmen, set sail with 1,700 barrels of alcohol. I assume it was whiskey or bourbon. It was coming from America going to Italy.
Right.
And that factors into some people's theories about what actually happened to the crew. But the ship bunks were... When the ship was discovered, the bunks were made. Everything was tidy. There was plenty of food still on board. While they had taken on some water, it wasn't sinking.
Mm-hmm.
In the captain's log, he wrote of spotting the Santa Maria Islands, but didn't note any problems with the ship, and that's near where it was found. The ship hadn't gone far without its crew. And then later, Arthur Conan Doyle, of Sherlock Holmes fame, wrote a scary fictionalized story about the ship and what might have happened. It was completely fiction, but people actually read it and thought that was the history of the ship.
Right. There's another short story in 1884, and that's when this ship really blows up. But there's actually a guy who was investigating this, an attorney general out of the Gibraltar area, I guess, at the time. And he was like a Fox Mulder kind of guy where it was all mystery. It was all mystery all the time.
Actually, one of the theories is that a sea monster attacked. It's not a good theory.
Let's look into that. But he basically gets told eventually to like knock it off, like quit, because he keeps going after the captain who finds the ship was on another ship, finds this ship. He's going, and so this attorney general.
They had met the week before. They had dinner together. So some people suspect that it might have been like some insurance fraud.
Right. Right. So this guy is goes after the other captain and finally gets like, you know, the 1800s equivalent of cease and desist and gets told, you can't keep doing this shit.
Yeah. When they brought the ship to the States for their money, there was a whole trial and they sort of debunked a lot of the myths about finding like a bloody sword or different elements that were just discredited at the time. But, you know, urban lore kind of catches fire and spreads. But yeah, so the ship, with its name, had a hard time keeping a crew after this discovery was put back into use, but it did eventually crash and sink off the coast of Haiti, so it's just part of a natural coral reef by now.
Nice. Now all the fish live there and get scared by ghosts.
So there are tons of scares in the movie, but they're all led up to by eerie noises accompanied by loud stingers. This is that kind of horror movie that,
absolutely,
like, it is just a fucking heavy-handed blow to the head every mm-hmm. time something scary is going to happen. There's not a lot of subtlety to
there
this movie.
There is no subtlety to this film. Even the ghosts that you do see, in, which, you know, normally maybe if you see a child ghost, a lot of times in movies nowadays you would just see the feet running, or you'd just see a leg, you wouldn't, you know, or you'd see some hair in the, that would be it. But this one you like full out see the ghost.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, then you're supposed to be surprised.
Yeah, it doesn't, I think one of the reasons I'm so hard on the movie is because I saw the potential. Like,
yeah.
The set design is fantastic. Like, it looks like money was spent. And then maybe the compulsion to like, well, let's just show everything.
Yeah.
And we get that. Some of the best elements are when Juliana Margulies is looking around to like the pool and recognizing like there are fucking shells and bullet holes along this pool.
Which doesn't make any sense when you find out what actually happened. The pool was full of water.
Yes.
So the shells wouldn't go through the pool and then go into the side.
Okay,
it's very bad.
We know that as like nerds who have heard at one point or another that like a bullet doesn't actually get through very much water with momentum. I think at most it's like 2 feet before it loses all power.
It's yeah, but this whole thing makes no sense.
This was, I don't know, before, you know what? A number of things in this movie might have been fixed. Plot holes might have been fixed with a single Google search.
Yes.
And is missing that at
yes,
times.
Yes, in 2002, apparently, Google was not a thing. And there's a few things. Like, there's a big explosion in the beginning, which leaves all of our crew now having to be forced to be on the big boat now. What's this boat called? I don't even know.
I don't remember.
Care.
It doesn't matter.
They're on this big cruise liner, and they can't go now on their other boat because their other boat has sunk and exploded. But it never tells how they got up back onto the giant boat. You can't just climb up a big fucking boat. You can't even climb up a yacht. That one movie wouldn't even exist if you could get right back on.
I don't know how they did it in the first place. I don't know how one boards a giant.
They had a crane on their boat
okay.
that like lifted them up. Or yeah, like a crane, you know, like the power guys use.
Yeah, it's a salvage boat. It's a tugboat. Yeah. But yeah, they didn't show that. It seems
no,
like
and then
that
suddenly they're like
difficult.
In the water and now they're on the boat. It's magic times. Like a big ladder.
Incidentally, that's the entire premise of the movie Open Water 2. The sequel to the Stranded in the Ocean, surrounded by sharks.
You cannot get up on a boat if you're in the water and there's no dock.
Gotta remember to put down that rope ladder, whatever the fuck you're gonna use.
Yeah, or you are fucked. So now they're stuck on the boat. Juliana Margulies sees the little red-haired girl, and then we're following her around, or Juliana Margulies is like, no, I don't believe in ghosts.
And so what I was saying is the story is best when she's noticing remnants and sort of putting together a vague story. Mm-hmm. There's obviously a bad vibe to the whole place. But I thought it would have been so much cooler if she puts it together for herself.
Right.
But instead, we get this little ghost girl who gives her like the mind meld flashback.
Right.
And we just get this entire film separate from our actual film.
I think it's because Juliana Margulies' character just wasn't fast enough. Like, the little girl was like, I am on a time schedule. I have to show you this because you're clearly, I'm giving you hints.
We'd be
this
here
whole time.
All day.
Yeah, it's like, I've been giving you hints for a while and you're not getting it. So here you go.
So Isaiah Washington has some moments with his crew. A big argument ensues. And after a half a bottle of wine in him, I guess that's him commiserating that night that like, oh, our ship is gone. And
well, because he's like a recovering alcoholic or something.
No, it's Gabriel Byrne's character.
Oh, I forgot what was happening.
But I was going to say Isaiah Thomas, the basketball player who's in this movie. Isaiah Washington has a half a bottle of wine and that's enough to get him thinking like, all right, I'll fuck a ghost. Why not?
He seems to be quickly after. And everyone seems to think this Italian lady is the shit.
I thought she was beautiful.
She's beautiful, but like, I'm not going to like get wasted and be like, you know that she's not on the boat. Like, why is he fooled by this?
Well, he even says the line,
can't cheat on your fiance with a dead girl, right?
That's where he's like, it's not cheating if it's with a ghost.
Right.
And this isn't like Ghostbusters, Dan Aykroyd sort of being creepily, that scene they wedged in where the ghost blowjob,
yes.
You remember that? Like, this isn't even that. He goes after her. Like,
yes.
He pursues this ghost for the purposes of ghost sex.
Yes.
And that, you know, befalls his ultimate end. But it's just it's fucking ridiculous. The special effects to that scene, though, are fantastic. The sort of rebuilding, the reconstruction of this 1962
yes.
ballroom happening around him is just anything having to do with his actual character is ugh.
Awful. And, yeah, he dies in one of the worst ways possible with, like, the pants. Like, he's, like, unzipping his – like, you're such an idiot. Oh, my God, that scene. This is one of those movies, quite honestly, that – it was one where I was kind of mad at you for making me watch it.
Oh, come on.
Because I had forgotten it entirely. And as soon as I saw the cover, I remembered to the old days of like Blockbuster when you used to judge movies yes. on the cover. Yeah. I was like, oh, yeah, I remember this. And then I was like, this is terrible. This is horrible.
Did you have like a emotional memory to the movie? You used to like it? No,
I don't even remember it the first time I watched it.
Oh, so this was like watching it for the first time, just
yeah. I mean, I
fresh
think I must
badness.
Have watched it in college because I knew the story as I was watching it, but I was like, oh my God, this is terrible, and like I couldn't tell if you liked it or not because we were trying not to talk about it before the show, and I was like, does he like this? And then I was all sorts of things were like up in the air after that. I was like,
why am I doing this show? His
he
taste
is so
is abysmal.
Terrible. And then I looked on Rotten Tomatoes and got a 14%. So I was like, that
right.
sounds about right.
So yeah, it doesn't even pay to like go through the ending. You know, it was meant to be a Hollywood blockbuster.
Right.
So what happens is exactly what you thought was going to happen.
Yes.
And you know, it
there's
tries
some
to...
other things. So then I looked into this because I'm not that great at geography. I mean, I could do well at the final of Carmen Sandiego. Like I could do well identifying countries and stuff, but. I'm not always that great. So I was like, Bering Strait, isn't that up by Alaska? Yet they're in the water all the time and she's wearing just like a tank top and she's not cold or freezing to death.
That's a good point.
Yeah. So then I looked it up and in 1987, someone actually swam across the Bering Strait
okay.
and it was 37 degrees in the water. So I don't think ugh. Juliana Margulies is like hanging out in the water.
They don't address temperature
fine.
Once.
No one, you can't see anyone's breath. No one talks. The ship would have ice and stuff all over it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not cold at all.
This ship is an anomaly in a number of ways.
Probably because it was filmed, I think, in Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was just absurd because then I was like, I don't. And then I got mad even just because it made me second guess myself because I was like, oh, maybe the Bering Strait's not where I thought it was. But it is, goddammit.
So segueing from one massive ocean liner
yes.
to a story regarding another, next movie is 2009's Triangle.
Yeah, which you don't hear much about.
I had never heard of it.
This was one, because, and I've told you, I like to explore like my journey of how I find some of these movies. Mm-hmm. And Triangle was, okay, firstly, is a disclosure. I have seen probably every of the 8 films to die for and every one of the After Dark Horror Fest. And so,
Grouper.
Yeah, when you kind of go through down that lane, you find yourself at Fright Fest. And that's how this movie, Triangle, came from London's Fright Fest.
Okay.
Yeah, which is an awesome festival, which is now kind of up in the air. And I don't know if there's going to be a 2016.
Oh.
They got new sponsors. It's all different now. So
I did notice on the opening credits that it was all about the UK Film Council
yep.
and that little icon that's like partially funded by the National Lottery.
Yes.
It's like I'd love it if the fucking Powerball paid for horror movies.
Movies? Wouldn't that be awesome? Back in those days, though, you would watch them because I think I even had DVDs from Netflix at the time.
Okay.
And you would get all these commercials and or trailers, and you wanted to watch the trailers. The trailers was the best thing because that's what told you about all these other movies.
Yeah.
You know what I do when I have a bad dream? I close my eyes, and I think of something nice.
So let's go sailing.
Wind's dropped out on us.
Get below deck now. Get the life jacket.
Oh, thank God.
Hello?
Where is everybody?
You enter a place you have never been.
I recognize this corridor.
Everything you see... you have seen before.
like starting over again. That's what's going on. Everything that happened to you before. He's dead! Change the pattern. You changed the pattern and now I'm trapped. Who are you?
So written, directed by Christopher Smith, who also put together Severance, mm-hmm. Black Death, and Creep, though not the one with Mark Duplass.
No. I've seen Creep. It was also a horror fest, I think. It's about a subway monster. That's what I was telling you about the other day.
We were talking about maybe a subway series, to speak.
Right, because I've been unfortunately having to ride the train, and it's awful.
It's a horror movie down there.
It is. It really is.
Midnight Meat Train. A lot of people don't know it's a documentary.
It is.
So starring Melissa George of Lonely Place to Die, 30 Days of Night, Turistas, and the Amityville Horror remake that you dug. Mm-hmm. I still haven't seen it.
It's worth a watch.
I will. I got nothing against it. I just haven't gotten there. Fellow Australian Liam Hemsworth, brother of Thor.
I don't think I'd ever seen him before this movie. He had been in some things, I really hadn't seen anything else.
Yeah, I think after this he was in...
He's one of the few Australian actors that's never been on Neighbours.
Okay.
Like, how did you become an Australian actor without Neighbours?
Well, it seems like he left pretty early. Like, before... So this would be around the time that he did the Hunger Games,
Is that... So he's not Thor.
No, that's Chris Hemsworth.
Oh, I see. I bet Chris Hemsworth was on Neighbours.
He might have been, if he's the oldest.
He's older.
It seems mostly Australian actors.
Yes.
And I guess it was probably cast in Australia because that's where they filmed.
Yes, it was.
They needed a lot of sort of ocean exposure.
But this is an English film.
Yeah. I guess English film director, I'm assuming. I think Christopher Smith is English. But in any case, I think the location drove them to the coast of Australia. And they talk about it on the making of that it was this sort of outlet, where it was surrounded by water on three sides, and they built up a substantial amount of this ship. They built a lot of the ship for this movie.
Yes, they did, because he didn't like the look of miniatures or green screen.
Yeah, I mean, for that much, it looks good. But
I like this movie. I don't know why you're, like, selling it poorly.
I've got nothing against the movie, really, but yes. The story revolves around the passengers of a yachting trip in the Atlantic Ocean who, when struck by mysterious weather conditions, jump to another ship only to experience great havoc on the open seas.
Yes.
It's funny how little of the plot that actually is.
But there's a reason.
Right, and that we're going to have to sort of tiptoe around this movie so as not to give away major elements, but... That is kind of the framework. Mm-hmm. All the character stuff is really where the story lays.
Yes.
So this group of friends, some of which know each other, others who don't, Melissa George enters the story like kind of disheveled in a sort of confused stupor. And all she knows is like she's got to get to this place because she was invited to take probably like a sailing weekend.
Right.
And, you know, she's got kind of a friendly, almost romantic relationship with the captain. And,
She's dropped her kid off at school, the end, and then now she goes on this trip.
Weekend away. Yeah. And then, so they're on the open waters when this sort of storm sneaks up on them. It's this, like, isolated thing that sort of finds them in the ocean, it seems.
And it overturns their boat.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, those are some of my favorite. That happens in The Reef, the shark movie. And I don't know, it's a very nerve-wracking idea.
Well, to me, I'm always in these movies when a boat capsizes, people are kind of under, or they have to get something from underneath, or all these items need to be acquired. And it's like, I can't hold my breath for like more than 10 seconds, probably.
That's probably something you should work on.
What, could you imagine? Like, I'm just holding my breath. My husband comes home and he's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, I'm practicing. Should I be in a boat that's capsized?
Should you do it in the bathtub? Actually submerged, because, hey, on the spot stress is going to be different.
And that's what the girl does, Richie, from Mermaids, the movie Mermaids. That's what she's doing in there.
So the movie does kind of float around this cycle, if not paradox, of regret. It's like a brutal version of It's a Wonderful Life at times. As close of a spoiler as I'll give, I'll suggest that its cyclical nature has a lot in common with Nacho Vigalondo's Time Crimes, which is an outstanding movie. And you know what? We didn't cover that much in our Spanish horror episode, so we should do that next time around.
Yeah, definitely.
But in this case, it really just is the sort of coming and going of these same characters and this ship that is it Aeolus?
Aeolus, which is from Sisyphus. That's Sisyphus's father in the myth of Sisyphus.
Oh, I didn't make that connection. Okay.
Yeah, and so this boat is kind of running the show and kind of gives you an idea what you're kind of in for if you know about Sisyphus or existentialism, things like that.
Yeah, they kind of treat the ship the way they, like the Overlook Hotel on The Shining.
Yes.
And they do specifically have to relay the Sisyphus Greek myth because it's sort of what's happening.
Sort of.
It's a version of what's happening. Somewhere, and I was thinking that between the mention of Sisyphus and just unrelated, but the idea of like Prometheus and his sort of penalty for stealing fire from the gods, the Greeks were kind of like, they were really good at like building Twilight Zone type stories before
there's some good
Western
ones.
Society.
Yeah, there's some good ones. And like most of the Greek mythology that I know comes from opera.
Okay.
So that sometimes they'll change the endings.
Like Disney changes.
Exactly, exactly, depending on what's going on. But I'm familiar with a lot of the myths because of opera, or the characters will wander into some shit. Like, Handel loves Greek mythology.
Hmm.
Yeah.
During the movie, there's a piece of music playing, and I didn't recognize it. I'm not that big a jazz or big band fan, but it's Glenn Miller.
Okay.
And it's another tie-in to the idea of, like, people gone missing over the ocean. I didn't know this, but Glenn Miller, the sort of famous musician and band leader, his plane went down over the English Channel in 1944 and was never found. So, like, that it happened during the war, you know, the English Channel's not that big.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that big a space. It's not exactly the Pacific Ocean to get lost in. So, I don't know. It was a little nod, a subtle little thing from the filmmaker.
That's
I enjoy that, yeah.
That's
and
very nice.
The movie does have that in the direction it is. It does what, like, time-looping stories need to have done well.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, you can't really leave plot holes out because, they'll literally overlap themselves.
Right.
But in this case, it works pretty well. And I don't know. It made me uneasy. The story. And that's why I'm a little hesitant to like go whole hog and say I loved it. I didn't quite love it, but like it made me uncomfortable.
Yeah, this movie is one of those movies that I was so happy that I found, and like I was telling you before, there was a certain kind of time and the way that these Fright Fest movies work, or the 8 Films to Die For, the After Dark, there were certain expectations from the audience, and if you weren't going to the theaters to see the latest, like, Texas Chainsaw or a Freddy Jason situation, this was kind of the other movie that you could, these other kind of movies that you could watch, and there was a very specific style to it. At this Fright Fest, the 2009 Fright Fest, is where The Horde comes from, French film The Horde. Evil Things, if you've ever seen that, which is definitely worth watching.
I haven't seen that one. I love The
and
Horde.
It has that same feeling. They all have this feeling, and that was the time. And which seems like 2009 wasn't that long ago, but it actually kind of was. It was 7 years ago, and styles have changed, and independent horror has changed in a different way. But also in 2009 was House of the Devil. So it's the same year that all of this was kind of happening. And yeah, if you didn't want to watch the big blockbusters, this was your other option. And it was before, I mean, really, Ty West was becoming huge. House of the Devil comes out the same year, and now you can look to these other guys, but yeah. I don't know. I think there's certain things about it that do feel dated and they feel old, and maybe they're not as polished as maybe we're used to now, but that's just how these films all are.
I think this one showed a lot of polish. I think this didn't have an American release, right?
Mm-hmm. No, never released in the U.S.
In thinking that this movie is very polished, it is surprising that it didn't get a wider release, at least, you know, sort of more mentioned, that I would have heard about it on VOD, you know,
right,
between then and now. But yeah, I don't know. I really liked it. I like Melissa George quite a bit.
Me too. I think she's great. I love when she shows up. So yeah. I was happy to see her do anything.
And it could have been a different movie. Apparently, Lindsay Lohan was in the running for this movie. And all the cast are using American accents, but even then, I think Lindsay Lohan would have stuck out as like one of these things.
That
would have
been horrible. That would have been the worst thing ever.
It could have been bad.
Oh my God. Closing out strong, and again with this idea of this 2010 kind of era of horror, independent horror, we have 2010's The Reeds, which was an After Dark Film Festival movie.
And this was one of the 8 films to die for?
After Dark later becomes 8 films to die for. It's okay. They're kind of the same thing.
And okay, it's just like a rebranding, but yeah, it's kind of the same source.
Yeah, because there's not, I don't think, a lot of money. There's a lot of money in the VOD, I think, part of these kind of films, but in the actual festivals, I think it's very small, and it's not really worthwhile to make these festivals. So
yeah,
you have After Dark,
After
Dark that turns into 8 Films to Die For, Horror Fest. You know, it's just how these things go. So we have The Reeds, directed by Nick Cohen, who I didn't really know anything that he had ever done.
Yeah, no, I mean, right? he made relatively small stuff.
Yeah, I never really heard of anything.
And not particularly hard. This on his resume, this kind of stood out as like the one scary thing, it seemed.
Yeah, and it's surprising because it is definitely a horror film with a horror feel. Sure. I think even just the color scheme, it goes nicely with Triangle. That would be like a great double feature, Triangle into The Reeds.
Yeah, and we'll talk about it in vague terms again because we don't want to give away spoilers, but it does have thematic consistencies, and
yes,
that's kind of for the listener to hopefully watch these movies and sort of pick out that why we put them together. But actually, for me, frankly, it was all a surprise because you found the last two. It's funny that I supplied the shitty one, and you're just like, these two indies are a lot better.
We're going to watch these now.
Let's course correct.
The grown-ups want to take control. No more Ghost Ship. Yeah, this one, though, as far as people at Stars, no one really that we know from anything.
No.
It's all English. You do recognize one of the guys.
You do.
I do, yeah. The character of Nick, I recognize from the TV show Looking, which I only watched like a few because it was like a terrible answer to Queer as Folk. Like HBO said, I want to do Queer as Folk, but in a bad, shitty way.
That was relatively new. Okay, recent. Yeah.
So he was on that show, but I didn't recognize anyone else from anything.
Yeah,
is that bad?
I mean, the movie is definitely a low-budget movie. It seemed like one of these, you know, very indie director moves where they've come upon a location that's brilliant, and they want to inject it with this story. They want to take advantage of the eerie factor, and that's kind of that was my feeling throughout this, that they really capitalized on the location and the setting.
Right.
The Reeds specifically is a reference to this sort of English bog of sorts.
Yeah, bog, right?
Yeah, I mean it's the
like
closest.
It's a peat bog that they flood. Or something.
Here we go. This should all keep the flies off. A couple of shots.
Nice.
Oh, sir. Someone fight.
Oh, it's methane from under the mud.
Methane?
Yeah.
Yeah, this whole area used to be a peat bog. And then in the Middle Ages, they dug it up for fuel. And then I think it was the 16th
century. No, it was the 17th century.
Yeah.
It all flooded because the sea level was rising.
Right, but this is the most diverse wildlife area in the whole
world. Oh, bore off.
Yeah. That brawl should up your ass.
Mel, stop filing your nails. Get your fanny up here.
But at the end of the day, it's still emitting methane.
So yes.
Not
which
unlike
they call methane, which I think is hilarious.
Yeah, I thought that was it's something about the elements. Aluminium, methane.
The methane.
Make it about you. but it reminded me of like the like American rural shows where they're just like in the bayou noodling.
Right.
And some of those waters, again, like years of decaying organic matter releases methane, and so oftentimes like you can't be in that water against your bare skin because it like sizzles and like eats at you.
That's terrifying.
It's pretty creepy. And that's the water they're in to like reach their arms into darkness and pull out catfish after it chomps on their arm.
Right.
Like, but this
but
is
in
the
this
far
movie they
nicer
don't plan on getting out. They do it when one guy gets a little drunk and jumps out for the fun of it, but quickly jumps back in.
Yeah. But the idea is they're never supposed to be stuck in the reeds. And it took me a second of like collecting my thoughts and the idea that wasn't the plan for their weekend. They were going to rent this boat and go out to the ocean where it's picturesque and nice.
Yes.
But instead, they're seemingly stuck in this labyrinth of high weeds.
Turning around. And I think it's a pretty shallow kind of thing. So it's really kind of telling them, you can only go this way.
Right. Yeah. You know? And the passageways are very narrow. They couldn't turn around if they wanted to. So when they get stuck and it's nightfall, like they talk about being expected at a local bar, and you know that's not going to happen because now it's nightfall and they're still lost. It's a disaster. I thought it was really funny. One of the character Chris is kind of the like inherent douchebag of the group.
Yes.
And with a couple drinks in him, he gets kind of aggressive and kind of nasty.
He sucks.
But his girlfriend is like debonair almost. Like she surprises
changes,
them.
Yeah, she changes into a ball gown and fancy earrings.
Somebody mentioned cocktails.
That is class.
And that doesn't work out for her.
No.
It doesn't really work out for anyone very well, let's say. It's a pretty grim story.
Yeah, where it kicks into high gear is when they fall upon a trap. They are unaware of the circumstances, but it is a sharp, like giant jagged piece of metal sticking out of this bog water floor, and it just lances through the bottom of the ship, stops them in motion, so everybody flies forward.
Right.
And Chris is the lucky taker who gets this massive piece of metal through his midside.
Which is like, if these kids didn't know, or they're all adults, if these adults didn't know that this was a horror movie, like, what? your friend just got impaled, and they're like trying to move him, and girl knows.
They know better. It's only time to move it.
Yeah, because she knows some sort of first aid or something.
They don't use the words, but they make it sound like she's a nurse or has some medical training. So they only try and move it when they need to, like, just literally unstick the boat from the bottom. But it's almost comical that this massive piece of metal is just speared through this guy, and he's holding on. And for the next, like, 25 minutes, he's just, like, the SNL sketch, the massive head wound Harry.
Yes!
And then it's just, like, a party taking place around this guy.
Because also, whenever they move on the boat, this is a continuity error, but when they're inside the boat and they move on the boat, then the boat moves and it moves this metal thing in and out of his body, essentially. I mean, it's disgusting. That's really gross. When you go up on top of the boat, they're moving around like it doesn't matter, and it doesn't apparently affect the rocking of the boat if you're on top of the boat. But yeah, they have to get this guy up, and I think that's a great scene just because for that moment, I thought to myself, if I didn't know I was in a horror movie, this would really suck. Like, what do you do? This is just a freak accident.
You're stuck. You're lost. This atmosphere, the reeds, it's probably my favorite thing about the movie is the location. Mm-hmm. Because I'd never really seen anything like that before. And the irony is, it looks like it smells.
Yeah.
And then they actually comment on it.
Because of the methane.
So Chris, who is really horribly wounded, they're sort of figuring out that, all right, well, someone should try and find another boat that's out there or get back to land or what have you. I thought it was funny when they are sort of drawing straws, so to speak, about who's going to go. They ask Nick that, like, you know, you're the next man up.
Yeah.
And he's like, I can't go out there.
He has my same answer. That's why.
Look, we don't have long.
Shit.
Basically, someone needs to go for help. Nick?
Me? No, I can't.
Why?
Look, I'm sorry. Look, I would if I could. I just... I can't swim.
You can't swim? Are you serious?
I was a fat kid. I went to, like, a rough school. It's okay. They didn't swim.
And it's so apparent that he just doesn't want to go out there. He doesn't give a fuck about Chris.
Right.
Enough to want to go in the water and, you know, risk whatever. But I thought it was just kind of funny that, like, even more so than the traditional golden rule of treating people as you would like to be treated.
He's like, no.
That, like,
because he can't swim. It's not his fault. That's what I would say, too.
Yeah, but he was lying. He was straight up lying.
No, he doesn't. He sinks to the bottom like a goddamn rock.
I thought, no.
Maybe he was playing at that point in time, but I don't think so.
No. I might be wrong. but I was just thinking, in terms of the golden rule, that like not just treating people as you would like to be treated, because when all things are good, it's real easy to smile at a stranger. Treat people how you would like to be treated if you were impaled by a massive sharp piece of metal. How about that? Because then you have a little like really compelling compassion for other people.
Yeah, not Nick. No. And in the meantime, while all of this is going on, we start to discover there's these kids that seem to be like wild kids running around.
Yeah.
And they're kind of fucking with these guys on the boat. So, I mean, partly maybe that's why Nick is like, no, I don't want to go out there. But it's still like not a good enough reason.
He had a vague scare where there was, you know, he
something
saw
in the reeds.
He's spooked by something before that. But I think ultimately he still just didn't want to go in the water.
No. I think it's cold,
but
too. I don't know.
Teenagers, well, not enough to Chris was skinny dipping. Before that,
that's true.
But nightfall. I mean, it was going to get cold. It was raining, so it was just miserable.
Yeah.
But yeah, these like seeming feral teenagers, which they encountered once before, hanging out on the boat that they rented. They're just, you know, sort of. They are the most vague element of this story. That they're just kind of behind grasses at different times,
kind of fucking with them,
barbecuing, so to speak.
Yes.
What? Did you see the kids?
Just a dead dog.
Nice.
Yeah. Little bastards tried to burn it.
They must have done a bunk or something when they had me coming.
But you don't really get a sense of them until the very end.
Right. So finally Joe does go out. Someone has to help this guy. Yeah. So Joe says, okay, fine. I'm going to go. He jumps in the water, which I think he could have just jumped on the land. I'm confused on where the water and the land end in this particular bog situation.
Yeah, the reeds... It looked as if like you could be on perfectly dry land running at full speed and then just come upon a hard water's edge.
Yeah.
Because like that however doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I don't know what this environment was really.
It's not like a bayou bog thing because they use those airboats because it's so shallow.
Right, they stay on the surface, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know.
The only thing you can be thankful of is that there were no alligators in the story.
You know what I thought at one point? So Joe's running through all these reeds, and I was like, it's a good thing there's no snakes. Because, there's no snakes in England, right? Is that a true statement?
That is my memory.
Is that a thing that Americans make up?
Well, no, I think it's true, but it's also is it St. Patrick. It was St. Patrick who drove out the snakes
of
from
Ireland. Not England.
Yeah, England could be full of snakes. I have no idea. He drove them out of Ireland and into England.
Straight to England.
This is all historical fact.
So you've noticed kind of like the reeds and triangle were being vague because we don't like to give spoilers. And I want you guys to go see these movies. But it's hard to talk about them without spoiling certain elements of it. And not like there's this huge big spoiler. It's just I wouldn't want someone to tell me as I'm going through the film. So that's why I think like being vague is the best for these movies.
Yeah. And I got the most out of this movie the second time watching it. I'm not saying that anyone needs to see it two times. I liked it, but I wasn't fully blown away. Mm-hmm. I think it sort of lost some momentum with the oddness towards the end. But all in all, it was still a really fun movie. And again, the visuals are unique. Although I wasn't wild about the editing. Some of it was a little... Okay. It almost felt a little like an art... Like an art student film. Like
that's
a
what I'm
film
talking
about.
You know that feel of that? To me, Triangle has a very similar feel, and that's just how...
I felt like that one had more polish.
No, I thought that's just how these movies were. I think, the reeds is probably on the lower end of the polish spectrum, I would say.
Yeah.
Definitely between Triangle and the reeds. But it's just, I don't know, I just expected that from these kind of movies. Just, they were all like that at that time.
Yeah, I wonder if the aesthetic was sort of catered around that, because one of the first things you do notice is that there is a seeming film grain to the look of it. And it's unusual to see that in this day and age where a small production like this is almost certainly shot on digital. And digital artifacts look like digital artifacts, but this looked like coarse film grain. And I don't know, it was a little conspicuous, but I think it's sort of – it probably – visually set the tone for what would come up in the movie.
Right. I mean, this particular After Dark Horror Fest had Dread, which is a Clive Barker story. And it kind of looks like that. And the Graves, if you've ever seen The Graves. I mean,
it also has Lake Mungo.
Yeah. And
which is one I've been eager to
feel at that time. And I can't like explain it because I'm not, I guess, good enough to explain it. But they all kind of had this particular feeling.
Like they all got like the same camera kit.
Yeah, kind of. And like, go have at it, kids. Have at it. I don't know. So I think if you were actually at the festival, it wouldn't have stood out as anything. I think we see such high polished films from independent filmmakers now.
Yeah.
Even though it's not been that long ago, it's still been quite a while ago. What is it?
I don't know, but it's not good in here.
So that'll close it out for this episode. I think I'll call it like the Dead Seas.
Oh, I like that. Something like that. That's good.
Yeah, we are on all the social media. Keep up with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Rance Macabre. Our website is therancemacabre.com. And you've learned at the top of this episode that we are now on Patreon. So join us there for exclusive content that only the Patreon patrons get. And we are at patreon.com/rancemacabre.
Yeah,
the first one out we put out, well, it'll be the week before this comes out, but we did a Night of the Living Dead retrospective, sort of talking about, well, we did the full production value thing where we pull clips from the movie and talk about themes and the context of the time. And
yeah.
We also
talk about Freud. We talk about all sorts of shit in that episode.
Yeah, yeah.
We have gone to the library.
That was a production-heavy, nerdy epic.
Yeah.
But yeah, we also talked about a movie that doesn't get talked about a lot, but Tom Savini's remake in 1990 of Night of the Living Dead, produced by George Romero. So it's, you know, it's of the family, and that is exclusive for Patreon supporters. So, yeah, we could always use your help. We got bills.
You've been listening to The Rance Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network, produced by Darren Rosario and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rance Macabre, contact Ken at fangoria.com.
This is me, Darren, signing off.
And this is Mindy. Thanks.